Tonight, we are privileged to have Dr. Peikoff speak to us on the topic medicine, the death of a profession, the effects of government funding of the practice of medicine. I now give you Dr. Leonard Peikoff.
Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. One day, when you are out of town on a business trip, you wake up with a cough, muscle aches, chills, and a high fever. You do not know what it is. You start to panic, but you do know one action to take. You call a doctor. He conducts a physical exam, takes a history, administers lab tests, narrows down the possibilities. Within hours, he reaches a diagnosis of pneumonia and prescribes a course of treatment, including antibiotics. Soon you begin to respond, you relax, the crisis is over. Or, you are getting out of your car, you fall and break your leg. It's a disaster, but you remain calm because you can utter one sentence to your wife: call the doctor. He proceeds to examine your leg for nerve and blood vessel injury. He takes x-rays, reduces the fracture, puts on a cast. The disaster has faded into a mere inconvenience, and you resume your normal life. Or your child comes home from school with a stabbing pain in the abdomen. There is only one hope. You call the doctor. He performs an appendectomy. The child recovers. We take all this completely for granted, as though modern drugs, modern hospitals, and modern doctors were facts of nature, which always had been there and which always will be there. Many people today take for granted not only the simpler kinds of medical intervention, such as the ones I just mentioned, but even the wonder cures and wonder treatments that the medical profession has painstakingly devised, like the latest radiation therapy for breast cancer, or the intricate delicacy of modern brain surgery, or such a breathtaking achievement as the artificial heart implants performed by Dr. William C. DeVries. Most of us expect that the doctors will go on accomplishing such feats routinely, steadily removing pain and thus enhancing the quality of our life while adding ever more years to its quantity. America's medical system is the envy of the globe. The rich from every other country, when they get sick, do not head for Moscow or Stockholm or even London anymore. They come here. And in some way, despite the many public complaints against the medical profession, we all know this fact. We know how good our doctors are and how much we depend on their knowledge, skill, and dedication. Suppose you had to go on a six-month ocean voyage with no stops in port, with ample provisions and sailors, but with only one other profession represented on board in addition, and you could decide which it would be. Would you ask for your lawyer to come along? Your accountant? Your congressman? Would you dare even to ask for your favorite movie star? Or would you say, bring a doctor, what if something happens? The terror of having no answer to this question is precisely what the medical profession saves us from. I am not saying that all doctors are perfect. They are not. Or that they all have a good bedside manner. They do not. Or that the profession is free from flaws. Like every other group today, the medical profession has its share of errors, deficiencies, weaknesses. But these are not my subject tonight, and they do not alter two facts: that our doctors, whatever their failings, do give us the highest caliber health care in world history, and that they live a grueling existence in order to do so. I come from a medical family, and I can tell you what a doctor's life is like. Most of them study nonstop for years in medical school and then work nonstop for the rest of their life. My own father, who was a surgeon, operated daily from 7 a.m. until noon and then made hospital rounds. From 2 to 6 p.m., he held office hours. When he came home for dinner, if he did, the phone never stopped ringing. It was nurses asking instructions, or doctors discussing emergency cases, or patients presenting symptoms. When he got the chance, usually late at night or on Sundays after rounds, he would read medical journals or write for them to keep abreast of the latest research. My father was not an exception. This is how most doctors in any branch of medicine live and how they work. The profession imposes not only killing hours, but also continuous tension. One way or another, doctors deal all the time with crisis, with accidents, diseases, trauma, disaster, the imminence of death. Even when an ailment is not a mortal threat, the patient often fears that it is, and he must be reassured, nursed through the terror, even counseled psychologically by the physician. The pressure on the doctor never lets up. If he wants to escape even for the space of a single dinner on the town, chances are that he cannot. He will probably get beat and have to rush to the emergency room just as the entree is being served. The doctor not only has to live and work in such a pressure cooker, he has to think all the time, clearly, objectively, scientifically. Medicine is a field that requires a vast fund of specialized theoretical knowledge. To apply it properly to particular cases, the doctor must continuously make delicate, excruciatingly complex decisions. Medical treatment is not usually a cut-and-dried affair with a simple, self-evident course of action. It requires the balancing of countless variables. It requires clinical judgment. And the doctor must not only exercise such judgment, he must do it fast. Typically, he has to act now. He cannot petition the court or his client or any employer for a postponement. He faces daily, hourly, the merciless timetable of nature itself. What I personally admire most about doctors is the fact that they live this kind of life, not out of any desire for altruistic self-sacrifice, but selfishly, which is the only thing that enables them to survive it. They love the field, most of them. They find the work a fascinating challenge in applied science. They are proud men, most of them, with an earned pride in their ability to observe, evaluate, act, cure. And thank God, they expect to be rewarded materially for their skill. They want to make a good living, which is the least men can offer them in payment for their achievements. They make that living, as a rule, by standing on their own, not as cogs in some faceless government-subsidized enterprise, but as entrepreneurs in private practice. In this regard, the doctors are among the last of the capitalist breed left in this country. They are among the last of the individualists that once populated this great nation. Ladies and gentlemen, if I knew nothing about today's world but the nature of our politicians and the philosophy represented by the medical profession, I would predict an inevitable clash, a catastrophic clash between the two, between the government and the doctors. On purely theoretical grounds, I would predict the destruction of the doctors by the government, which in every field now protects and rewards the exact opposite of thought, effort, and achievement. This evening, I want to tell you that this catastrophe is actually taking place, and in what manner and how it will affect your future as well. To understand what is happening in medicine today, we must go back to the beginning, which in this case is 1965, the year when Medicare and Medicaid were finally pushed through Congress by Lyndon Johnson. Medicare, as you may know, covers most of the medical expenses of those over 65, whatever their income. Medicaid is a supplemental program for the poor of any age. Those of us who opposed the Johnson plan argued at the time that government intervention in medicine is immoral in principle and would be disastrous in practice. No man, we claimed, has a right to medical care. If he cannot pay for what he needs, then he must depend on voluntary charity. Government financing of medical expenses, we argued, even if it is for only a fraction of the population, necessarily means eventual enslavement of the doctors, and as a result, a profound deterioration in the quality of medical care for everyone, including the aged and the poor. The proponents of Medicare were unmoved by any arguments. Altruistic service to the needy, they said, is man's duty. It is degrading, they said, for the elderly to be dependent on private charity. A means test is incompatible with human dignity. Besides, they added, the government would not dream of asking for any control over the doctors or over their methods of patient care. All we want the state to do, they said, is pay the bills. Well, it is now 1985. Let us look at what actually happened. The first result of the new program should have been self-evident. Suppose we apply the same principle to nutrition. Suppose President Johnson had said, it's unfair to have to pay for your own food and restaurant bills. Men have a right to eat. Washington, therefore, will pick up the tab. Can you project the results? Can you imagine the eating binges? The sudden mania for dining out? The soaring demand for baked peacock tongues and other gourmet delicacies? Do you see Lutece and the 21 Club becoming nationally franchised and starting to outdraw McDonald's? Why not? The eaters do not have to pay for it. And the food industry, including its most sincere members, is ecstatic. Now that the money is pouring from Washington into the grocery chains and the restaurants, they can give every customer the kind of luxury treatment once reserved for millionaires. Everybody is happy, except that expenditure on food becomes so great a percentage of our gross national product, and the drain on the federal treasury becomes so ominous that every other industry starts to protest, and soon even the bureaucrats begin to panic. This is what happened to medical spending in the United States. The patients covered by the new programs no longer had to pay much attention to cost. That was the whole purpose of the programs. And the healthcare professionals in the beginning were generally delighted. Now many of them felt the sky is the limit, and they proceeded to build hospitals, purchase equipment, and administer tests accordingly. Medical expenditures in the United States were 4.3% of GNP in 1952. Today they are about 11% and still rising. Medicare expenditures doubled from 1974 to 1979, doubled again by 1984, and are projected to double again by 1991, at which time, according to most current estimates, the Medicare program will be bankrupt. Something the government recognized has to be done. We are going broke because of the insatiable demand for medical care. The government did not decide to cancel its programs and return to a free market in medicine. When are disastrous government programs ever canceled? Instead, it did what governments do. It decided to keep the programs but impose rigid controls on them. How? The first step was a campaign to force hospitals not to spend much on Medicare patients, no matter what the effects on the health of those patients. We will no longer, officials said, pay hospitals a fee for each service they render a Medicare patient. That method of payment, they said, simply encourages spending. Instead, we will pay according to a new principle, DRGs. Remember those letters, DRG. They represent the first major assault by the government against the doctors and their patients. It is not yet the strangulation of the medical profession, but it is the official dropping of the noose around their necks. DRG means diagnosis related group. According to this approach, the government has divided all ailments into 468 possible diagnoses and has set in advance a fixed arbitrary fee for each. It will pay a hospital only what it claims is the average cost of the ailment. For example, for a Medicare patient in the Western Mountain region who is admitted to a hospital with a heart attack and finally recovers enough to go home, the government now pays the hospital exactly $5,094, no more and no less. And it pays this amount no matter what the hospital actually does for the patient, no matter how long his stay or how short, no matter how many services he requires or how few. If the patient costs the hospital more than the government payment, the hospital loses money on him. If he costs less, the hospital makes a profit. That's today's system. Let us pursue the heart attack example for a moment. Here is a fictional story now in process of becoming reality around the country. A man suffering from severe chest pains is taken by ambulance to the hospital. He receives certain standard tests, including a cardiogram, then is moved to the intensive care unit, the ICU, where his vital signs are continuously monitored. His doctor thinks that in this instance, a further test, an angiogram, is urgently indicated. This test would outline the arteries of the heart and indicate if one is about to close off, an event that could be fatal. The hospital administrator protests. An angiogram is expensive. It costs up to $1,000, about 20% of our total fee for this man. And who knows what else he's still going to cost us. You can't prove that this test is necessary, he says. Let's wait and see. The test is not given. Maybe the patient lives, maybe not. Several days later, the administrator comes to the doctor. You've got to get this man out of the ICU. It's costing almost $800 per day, and he's been there now for 5 days. What with everything else, we've already spent almost the whole payment we get for him. The doctor thinks that the patient still desperately needs the specialized nursing available only in the intensive care unit. The administrator overrules him. There's an area of judgment here, he says. We'll just have to take a bit of a chance on this case. Or the doctor decides that the patient is an excellent candidate for remedial heart surgery. A bypass operation, he thinks, would probably prolong the man's life considerably while relieving him of pain. But the man, after all, is elderly, and the operation would involve a lengthy hospital stay. Let's try a more conservative treatment first, the administrator says. Let's give him some medication and wait and see. Again, maybe the patient lives. Maybe not. Let us say that he lives and goes back to the regular ward in the hospital. He still feels very weak, and the doctor does not think he is anywhere near ready to be discharged, but the $5,094 has long since been spent, and the administrator starts to wonder aloud, maybe this man could manage somehow at home. In any event, he's eating us alive. Get him out of here. Maybe the patient will survive at home. Maybe not. Do you see the thrust of the system? If the hospital does relatively little for the patient, it makes money. If it provides an extensive range of services, it loses heavily. The best case from its viewpoint is for the patient to die right after admission. The hospital still gets the full fee. The worst case is for him to survive with complications and require a lengthy stay, which is why some hospitals are now refusing to admit patients they fear will linger on too long. I do not mean to suggest that our hospitals are now merely shrugging and callously withholding urgently needed treatment from Medicare patients. Today's hospitals and doctors do have integrity. Most are continuing to do their very best for the patient. The point is that they have to do it now within the DRG constraints. The issue is not simply treat the patient or let him die. The issue is treat him how, at what cost, with what range of services, specialists, and equipment, with what degree of safety or of risk. This is the area where there is enormous room for alternatives in the quality of medical treatment. And this is the area that is now in the process of being slashed across the board for Medicare patients, the very people singled out by the liberals in the 1960s as needing better medical care. To revert to our nutrition analogy, it is as though the government socialized eating out, then paid restaurants in advance only what it computed as the average cost per meal. There would then be a powerful incentive for restaurants to cut corners in every imaginable way, to serve only the cheapest foods, in the smallest amounts, in the cheesiest settings. What do you think would happen to the nation's eaters and its chefs under such a setup? How long could the chefs preserve their dedication to preparing haute cuisine when the restaurant owners in self-preservation were forced to fight them at every step and to demand junk food instead? The same answer applies to our doctors today. There is now a new and deadly pressure on the doctors, which continuously threatens the independence and integrity of their medical judgment. The pressure to cave in to utterly arbitrary DRG economies while blanking out the effects on the patient. In some places, hospitals are now offering special financial incentives to the physician who averages out at relatively low cost. For example, a hospital might subsidize such a doctor's office rent or purchase new equipment for him. On the other hand, a doctor who insists on quality care for his Medicare patients and thereby drives up costs is likely to incur the hospital's displeasure. In the extreme case, the doctor risks being denied staff privileges, which means cutting off his major source of livelihood. Thanks to DRGs, a new conflict is in the offing, just starting to take shape. The patient versus the hospital. Or to put it another way, the conflict is doctors versus hospitals. Doctors fighting a rearguard action to maintain standards against hospitals that are forced by the government to become cost-cutting ogres. How would you like to practice a profession in which half your mind is devoted to healing the patient, while the other half is trying to appease a hospital administrator who himself is trying to appease some official in Washington? And remember that Medicare patients are not a small group. On the contrary, because of their age, they constitute a significant part of most doctors' practice. Medicare patients now make up about 50% of all hospital admissions in the United States. The defenders of DRGs answer all criticisms by saying that costs simply must be cut. Even under complete capitalism, they say, doctors could not give unlimited treatment to every patient. This is true, but it ignores two crucial facts. One, it is because of government programs that medical prices have soared so high and are now out of reach for masses of patients. This was not true in the days of private medicine. The average American a generation ago could afford quality in medicine as in every other area of life without courting bankruptcy. And the second point is this: even if a patient could not afford it, at least in the pre-welfare state era, he was told the truth. As a rule, he was told about the treatment options available, and it was up to him, in consultation with his doctor, to weigh the various possibilities and decide how to cut costs. But under the present system, the hospital not only has to cut services drastically, it is to its interest to conceal this fact from the patient. If he or his family ever learns that the angiogram he is not going to have or the heart surgery would make all the difference to the outcome of his case, he would immediately protest violently, insist on the service, even threaten to launch a malpractice suit. The system is rigged to squeezing every drop of quality out of medical care so long as the patient does not understand what is happening. The patient does not know medicine. He relies on the doctor's integrity to tell him what services are available and necessary in his case. Yet increasingly, the hospitals must try to batter down that integrity. They must try to make the doctor keep silent and not tell the patient the full truth. Under the new system, the patient is no longer a free man to be accorded dignity and respect, but a puppet on the dole to be manipulated accordingly, while the doctor is transformed from a sovereign professional into a mere appendage and accessory, a helpless tool in a government-orchestrated campaign of shoddy quality and deception. The government's takeover of medical practice is not confined only to public patients. It is starting to extend now into the private sector as well. This brings me to the HMOs, which are now mushrooming all over the country. HMO means Health Maintenance Organization. It could also have been called BBM, for Bargain Basement Medicine. In this setup, a group of doctors, perhaps with their own hospital, offers prepaid, all-inclusive medical care at a cheap rate. For a fixed payment in advance, a payment substantially less than a regular doctor would charge, the patient is guaranteed virtually complete coverage of his medical costs, no matter what they are. The principle here is exactly the same as that of the DRG system. If the patient's costs exceed his payment, the HMO loses money on him. If not, it makes a profit. Although HMOs are privately owned, the spread of these organizations is wholly caused by government. There were very few HMOs in the days of private medicine. As part of the government's campaign to lower the cost of medical care, however, Washington has recently thrown its immense weight behind HMOs, even going so far as to advertise nationally on their behalf and to give them direct financial subsidies. How do HMOs achieve their low rates? In essence, by the DRG method, the method of curtailing services. In this case, however, the cuts in quality are even more sweeping, inasmuch as the HMO embraces every aspect of medical care and not merely hospital costs. For example, HMO doctors do not generally have personal patients, nor does the patient generally have a choice of doctors or even necessarily see the same one twice. That is too expensive. The patient sees whoever is on duty when he shows up. The doctor gives up the luxury of following a case from beginning to end. Nor does the doctor have much time to spend with a given patient. HMOs are generally understaffed to save money. Typically, there are long waiting lines of patients. Further, the doctor must obtain prior authorization of any significant expenditure from a highly cost-conscious administrator. The doctor may detect a possible abdominal tumor and request a CAT scan. In effect, an exquisitely detailed 3D x-ray. But if the administrator says to him, "It costs a lot, I don't think it's necessary," the doctor is helpless. Or he may find that the patient has an aneurysm, a weakening of an artery that is like a time bomb waiting to go off, and he may want to operate to remove it. But the administrator can reply, "These cases often go years without rupturing. Let's wait a while." Like the doctor under DRGs, the HMO doctor, too, ultimately has to obey. He either keeps his costs within the dictated parameters or he's out of work. What kind of doctors are willing or eager to practice medicine under these conditions? In large part, they represent a new breed, new at least in quantity. There is a generation of utterly unambitious young doctors growing up today, especially conspicuous in the HMOs. Doctors who are the exact opposite of the old-fashioned physician in private practice. Doctors who want to escape the responsibility of independent thought and decision, and who are prepared to abandon the prospect of a large income or a private practice in order to achieve this end. These doctors do not mind the forfeit of their professional autonomy to the HMO administrator. They do not object to practicing routine, cut-rate medicine with faceless patients on an assembly line basis, so long as they themselves can escape blame for any bad results and cover their own tracks. These are the new bureaucratic doctors, the MDs with the mentality and the fundamental indifference to their job of the typical post office clerk. I hasten to add that there are better doctors in the HMOs, and that some HMOs are better than others. As a rule, however, the better doctors in these organizations are mercilessly exploited. Being conscientious, the better men put in longer hours than necessary, trying to make up for the chronic understaffing. They do not give in meekly to arbitrary decrees on cost, but fight the administrator when they feel their own judgment is right. Increasingly, their professional life becomes a series of such fights, which makes them the heavies, hard to get along with, and guilty of costing the HMO money, while their lesser colleagues capitulate to the system and take things easy. Time after time, the better men step in to bail out such colleagues, struggling to correct their errors, clean up their messes, rescue their patients. At a certain point, however, the better doctors start to get fed up. An HMO doctor in California, a qualified internist and a highly conscientious woman whom I know personally, told me the following story. I was looking through a pile of cardiograms one day, she said, and I saw one that was clearly abnormal. I knew that the man should be taken by ambulance to the emergency room for retesting and possible hospitalization. Then I thought, she said, it's late Friday afternoon, and it's going to take an hour and a half, and I'm not being paid for the extra work, and who will know if I wait until Monday? I was tempted for a moment to drop the whole thing and go home. But then the remnants of my conscience made me get up wearily and telephone the patient. This sort of thing, she concluded, happens all the time, and not just to me, and often the doctor does simply look the other way, unquote from her statement. Do you see what happens under a system in which the doctor is penalized for his virtue, or at the least is deprived of any incentive, spiritual or material, including pride in his judgment and payment for his work? Would you like your cardiogram to be in a pile on this new breed's desk? Yours is next. All of ours are. Because the cancer is growing inexorably. The debased standards inherent in government medicine are now spreading to the whole of medical practice in the United States. The new medicine is not restricted to Medicare patients or to HMO members. It is soon going to engulf private doctors as well, even when they see their own private paying patients. There are many reasons for this. The most obvious is the pressure from the health insurance companies, such as Blue Cross and Blue Shield. Hospitals now are charging higher rates to private patients in order to recoup their losses on Medicare cases. As a result, the private insurance companies are screaming and demanding that a DRG-type system be imposed uniformly on all patients. They want private insurance policies from now on to pay only according to arbitrary preset DRG rates, just as Medicare does now, which would put the total of medicine in this country, all patients, all doctors, all ailments, into the same category as the heart attack patient we discussed earlier. His fate would become everyone's, and the standards of American medicine would simply collapse. If this demand of the insurance companies surprises you, remember that there are no truly private health insurance companies in the U.S. today. What we have, in essence, is a government-protected, government-regulated cartel in this field. And what the cartel wants is not more freedom, but more money as a result of government favors, including stiffer government controls over medical costs. The end of the Medicare road, in other words, is complete socialized medicine. Now you can see the absurdity of the claim that state payment of medical bills will not affect the freedom of physicians or the quality of patient care. State funding necessarily affects and corrupts every private service. Communism, in fact, is essentially nothing more than state funding. The Soviets pretty much leave doctors and everyone else free to dream or fantasize within their own skulls. All the government does is fund everything. In other words, take over the physical means of every citizen's existence. The enslavement of the country, and thus the collapse of all standards, follows as a matter of course. Now let me backtrack for a minute. I've been maintaining that the cause of our medical crisis today, including our soaring health care costs, is government funding of medical care. Many observers, however, claim that the cause is something different, namely the rapid advances in medical technology, such as CAT scans or the latest, most sophisticated disease-detecting instruments, the nuclear magnetic resonance, or NMR machines. Some people, accordingly, want to limit medical technology severely or even abolish it. Let me answer this objection briefly. Technology by itself does not drive up costs. In fact, it generally reduces costs and improves the quality of life. The normal pattern, as exemplified by the automobile industry, is a new invention is expensive at first, so that only a few can afford it. But inventors and businessmen persevere, aiming for the profits that come from a mass market. Eventually, they discover cheaper and better methods of production. Gradually, costs come down until the general population can afford to buy. No one is bankrupted, everyone gains. What creates national bankruptcy is not technology, but technology injected into a field by government decree apart from supply and demand. That is what is happening in medicine today. State-of-the-art medical treatment, including new inventions or procedures that are still prohibitively expensive. For instance, liver transplants and long-term kidney dialysis. This kind of treatment is being financed by the government for the total population in the name of egalitarianism. The result is the unbelievable expenditures that are made routinely in our hospitals, far beyond most people's capacity to afford. I mean the expenditures made on behalf of certain categories of patients, especially the terminally ill, who almost always fall under the umbrella of some government-supported insurance program. It has been estimated that 1% of our gross national product, 1%, is now spent on the dying in their last weeks of life. Did you hear that? Or looked at in another way, one half of a man's lifetime medical expenses occur now in the last 6 months of his life. In a free society, you yourself would have to make a choice. Do you want to defer consumption, cancel vacations, forego pleasures year after year, so as to extend your life in the ICU by a few months at the end? If you do, no one would interfere under capitalism. You could hoard your cash and then have a glorious spree in the hospital as you die. I wouldn't care to do this. It does not bother me that some billionaire can live months longer than I by using machinery that I couldn't dream of affording. I would rather be able to make ends meet, enjoy my life, and die a bit sooner. But in a free society, you are not bound by my decision. Each man would make and finance his own choice. The moral principle here is clear cut. A man has a right to act to sustain his life, but no right to loot others in the process. If he cannot afford some science fiction cure, he must learn to accept the facts of reality and make the best of it. In fact, in a free society, the few who could easily afford costly discoveries would, by the normal mechanism, help bring the cost down. Gradually, more and more of us could afford more and more of the new technology, and there would be no health cost crisis at all. Everyone would benefit, no one would be crushed. The terminally ill would not be robbing everyone else of his life, as is happening now, thanks to government intervention. The elderly would not be devouring the substance of the young. Well, now let me return to my main theme. Have I now covered, at least in essence, the ways in which government is wrecking the practice of medicine and tightening the noose around the doctors' necks? I have barely scratched the surface. For example, I have not even mentioned the formal introduction of the principle of collectivism into medical practice, of committee medicine as against individual judgment. This is exemplified by the flourishing PROs, or professional review organizations in our hospitals, which act to oversee and strengthen the various DRG controls. It's a whole alphabet today. PROs are committees of doctors and nurses established by the government to monitor the treatment of Medicare patients and especially to cut its cost. Committees with substantial power to enforce their arbitrary judgments on any dissenting doctor. These committees are the equivalent in the Medicare system of the HMO administrators and have potentially the same kind of all-encompassing power to forbid hospital stays along with the associated tests and surgical procedures that the admitting doctor thinks are required. Nor have I yet mentioned CONs, Certificates of Need. Since the government regards anything new in the field of medicine as potentially expensive, a hospital today is prohibited from growing in any respect, whether we speak of more beds or new technology, unless the administrator can prove need to some official. Now, since need in this context is undefined and unprovable, the operative criterion here is not need at all, but pull, political pull. Under this program, the government last year denied Sloan Kettering, the famous New York Cancer Hospital, the right to purchase an NMR machine because another New York hospital already had it. Later, the government backed down in the face of the resulting public uproar. But what about the hospitals that do not enjoy such fame or contacts and that are inexplicably denied permission to acquire a new and crucial diagnostic tool? So far, the freeze on them is only partly effective because doctors are still allowed to purchase new equipment for their own offices, which hospital patients now often use. But the government is fighting to close this loophole. It is on the verge of decreeing that private doctors in their own offices, out of their own funds, cannot purchase new equipment without a government certificate of need. Here again, by the way, you can see how your care will be affected even if you are not a Medicare patient. If your doctor or hospital is not allowed the equipment, you cannot benefit from it either. It isn't there. It doesn't exist. Nor have I mentioned the hundreds, and that's not an exaggeration, hundreds of other government interventions in medicine. State legislatures alone in the space of a year recently enacted almost 300 pieces of health cost containment legislation. One hospital in New York now reports to 99 separate regulatory agencies. And I have not yet even touched on what is perhaps the most demoralizing crisis in the field of medicine today, demoralizing to the doctors. The malpractice crisis. We must, however, pause on this one for a moment because it illustrates dramatically, in yet another form, the lethal effects of government intervention in the field of medicine. Medical malpractice suits have trebled since 1975. There are now about 16 lawsuits for every 100 doctors. In addition, awards to plaintiffs today average around $750,000 and are steadily climbing. The effect of this situation on physicians is unspeakable. First, I have been told there is fear, chronic fear, the terror of the next attorney's letter in the mail. Then there is the agony of drawn-out legal harassment, including endless depositions and a protracted trial. There is the exhaustion of feeling that one lives in a malevolent universe and that every patient is a potential enemy. Always there is the potential nightmare, a career-destroying verdict. And whatever the verdict, win or lose, there is the fact that all of the doctors, innocent and guilty alike, are paying for it. They are paying for the exorbitant awards in the form of unbelievable insurance premiums. Over $100,000 per year per physician in some places.
In response to this situation, doctors are forced to engage wholesale in what is called defensive medicine. In other words, the performing of unnecessary tests or procedures solely in order to build a legal record and thereby prevent the patient from suing later.
For example, I heard about the case of a man falling and bumping his. Since there was no evidence of any head injury, there was no basis in the doctor's judgment to order an expensive series of skull x-rays. But if he does not order it, he takes a chance. If months or even years later, the man should develop mysterious headaches, the doctor might be sued. He might be charged retroactively with negligence, since he omitted a test that might have shown something that might have prevented the headaches. So the doctor has no choice. He has to order the test to protect himself. By a conservative estimate, defensive medicine now accounts for about one-third of all health care costs. The medical profession did not suddenly turn evil or irresponsible in the last decade or so. We must ask, what is the cause of the soaring lawsuits? The most immediately apparent answer lies in the law, which has now lost any pretense at rationality. The standards of liability are corrupt. Negligence, in any rational sense of the term, is no longer the legal standard. Today's standard, in effect, demands of the doctor not responsible care, but omniscience and omnipotence. For example, if a doctor prescribes a drug that is safe by every known test, and years later it is discovered to have side effects undreamed of at the time, the doctor can be sued. Was he negligent? No, merely non-omniscient. If he treats a patient with less than the most expensive technology, whether the patient can afford it or not, he can be sued. Quote, you open yourself to a malpractice suit. This is from an attorney in the field. If you give even the appearance of letting financial considerations conflict with good patient care, unquote. Or, if a baby has a birth defect that can be ascribed to the trauma of labor, the obstetrician may be sued for not having done a cesarean, even though there were no advance indications for one. Because, as one obstetrician puts it, most people, quote, assume that anything less than perfection is due to negligence, unquote. This last statement actually reveals the operative principle of the law today, not of some crackpot radical, but of the law. The patient is entitled to have whatever he wishes, regardless of cost or means. It makes no difference what doctors know or whether the money exists. The patient's desire is an absolute. The doctor is a mere serf, expected to provide all comers with an undefined, perfect care somehow. Do you see where this idea comes from? It is the basic principle which underlies and gave birth to Medicare. You, the patient, Washington said in the 1960s.
You need do nothing to earn your medical care or your cures. From now on, you need merely wish, and the all-powerful government will do the rest for you somehow. Well, now we see the result. We see the rise of a generation of patients and lawyers who believe it, who expect treatment and cures as a matter of right simply because they wish it, and who storm into court when their wish is frustrated. The government not only inculcates such an attitude psychologically, but makes it seem financially feasible as well, because Washington has poured so much money into the field of medicine for so long. How else could anyone afford the defensive tests or the inflated medical prices necessary to help pay for the incredible malpractice awards? They could not have been afforded in a free market context. In the days of private medicine, there was no malpractice crisis. There was neither the public psychology nor the irresponsible funding that it requires. But now, thanks to government, there is both. And there is also a large enough core of unscrupulous lawyers who are delighted to cash in on the disaster. Lawyers who are eager to extort every penny they can from conscientious, bewildered, and in most cases, utterly innocent doctors, while grabbing off huge contingency fees for themselves in the process. The only solution to the malpractice crisis is a rational definition of malpractice, which would restrict the concept severely to cases of demonstrable negligence or irresponsibility within the context of objective definitions of these terms, taking into account the knowledge and the money available at the time. But this is impossible until the government gets its standards and its cash out of the medical business altogether. Ladies and gentlemen, we are all kept alive by the work of man's mind, the individual minds that still retain the autonomy necessary to think and to function. In medicine, above all, the mind must be left free. Medical treatment, as I've said, involves countless variables and options that must be taken into account, weighed, summed up by the doctor's mind and subconscious. Your life depends on the private inner essence of the doctor's function. It depends on the input that enters his brain and on the processing such input receives from him. What is being thrust now into the equation? It is not only objective medical facts any longer. Today, in one form or another, the following also has to enter that brain. The DRG administrator will raise hell if I operate, but the malpractice attorney will have a field day if I don't. And my rival down the street who heads the local PRO favors a CAT scan in these cases. I can't afford to antagonize them, but the CON boys disagree, and they won't authorize a CAT scan for our hospital. And besides, the FDA prohibits the drug I should be prescribing, even though it's widely used in Europe, and the IRS might not allow the patient a tax deduction for it anyhow. And I can't get a specialist's advice because the latest Medicare rules prohibit a consultation with this diagnosis. And maybe I shouldn't even take this patient, he's so sick. After all, some doctors are manipulating their slate of patients. They accept only the healthiest ones, so their average costs are coming in lower than mine, and it looks bad for my staff privileges, etc. Would you like your case to be treated this way? By a doctor who takes into account your objective medical needs and the contradictory, unintelligible demands of 99 different government agencies and lawyer squads. If you were a doctor, could you comply with all of it? Could you plan for or work around or deal with the unknowable? But how could you not? Those agencies and lawyer squads are real, and they are rapidly gaining total power over you and your mind and your patients. In this kind of nightmare world, if and when it takes hold fully, thought is helpless. No one can decide by rational means what to do. A doctor either obeys the loudest authority or he tries to sneak by unnoticed, bootlegging some good health care occasionally, or he gives up and quits the field. Now you can understand why the philosophy of objectivism holds that mind and force are opposites, and why innovation always disappears in totalitarian countries, and why doctors and patients alike are going to perish under socialized medicine if its invasion of this nation is not reversed. Conservatives sometimes observe that government, by freezing medical fees, is destroying the doctor's financial incentive to practice. This is true enough, but my point is different. With or without incentive, the doctors are being placed in a position where they literally cannot function, where they cannot think, judge, know what to do, or act on their conclusions. Increasingly, for a man who is conscientious, today's government is making the practice of medicine impossible. The doctors know it, and many have decided what to do about it. In preparation for this talk, I spoke to or heard from physicians around the country. I wanted to learn their view of the state of their profession. From New York to California, from Minnesota to Florida, the response was almost always the same. I'm getting out of medicine. I can't take it anymore. I'm putting every cent I can into my pension plan. In 5 years, I'll retire. Such is the reward our country is now offering to the doctors in payment for their life-saving dedication, effort, and achievements. As to talented newcomers rising to replace the men who quit, I want to point out that medical school enrollments are now dropping. Bright students today, says the president of the Mount Sinai School of Medicine, are, quote, discouraged by the perception of growing government regulation of medicine, unquote. Note that it is bright students about whom he speaks. The other kind will always be in ample supply. Any government program has beneficiaries who fight to keep the program going. Who is benefiting from the destruction of the doctors? It is not the poor. A generation ago, the poor in this country received excellent care through private charity, comparatively much better care than they are going to get now under the DRG and HMO approaches. The beneficiary is not the poor, but only one subgroup among them. Those who do not want to admit that they are charity cases. Those who want to pretend that they are entitled to medical handouts as a matter of right. In other words, the beneficiary is the dishonest poor who want righteously to collect the unearned and consider it an affront even to have to say thank you. And there is another beneficiary, the new 9-to-5 civil servant doctor, the kind who once existed only on the fringes of medicine, but who now basks in the limelight of being a physician and healer because his betters are being frozen out. And there is one more beneficiary, the medical bureaucrats, lobbyists, legislators, and the malpractice lawyers. In short, all the force wielders now slithering out of their holes, gorging themselves on unearned jobs, money, fame, and or power, by virtue of having sunk their fangs into the body of the medical profession. Altruism, as Ayn Rand has demonstrated, does not mean kindness or benevolence. It means that man is a sacrificial animal. It means that some men are to be sacrificed to others. The United States today is a textbook illustration of her point. The competent doctors, along with their self-supporting patients, are being sacrificed to the parasites, the incompetents, and the brutes. This is how altruism always works. This is how it has to work by its nature. The doctors resent today's situation passionately. Many of them are ready to quit, but not to fight for their field. At least not to fight in the manner they would have to if they were to have a chance of winning. In part, this is because the doctors are frightened. They sense that if they speak out too loudly, they may be subject to governmental reprisals. Above all, however, tragically, the doctors feel guilty. Their own professional motivation, The personal, selfish love of their field and of their mind's ability to function is noble, but they do not know this. For ages, they have had it pounded into them that it is wrong to have a personal motivation, wrong to enjoy the material rewards of their labor, wrong to assert their own individual rights. They have been told over and over that they should want to sacrifice themselves to society, even if they don't. And so they are torn now by a moral conflict and silenced by despair. They do not know what to say if they quit or how to protest their enslavement. They do not know that selfishness, the rational selfishness they embody and practice, is the essence of virtue. They do not know that they are not servants of their patience, but, to quote Ayn Rand, traitors like everyone else in a free society. And they should bear that title proudly, considering the crucial importance of the services they offer, unquote. If the doctors could hear just this much and learn to speak out against their jailers, there would still be a chance. But only if they speak out as a matter of solemn justice, upholding a moral principle, the first moral principle, self-preservation. Thereafter, in practical terms, they and all of us could advocate the only solution to today's crisis, removing its primary cause. In other words, closing down Medicare. Not reducing its budget, that will simply tighten the DRG noose, but repealing the program altogether. In principle, the method is simple. Phase it out in stages. Let the government continue to pay on a sliding scale for those who are already too old to save for their final years. But give clear notice to the younger generations that there is a cutoff age and that they must begin now to make their own provision for their later medical costs. Is there still time for such a step? The most I can answer is in 10 years there won't be. That is how fast things are moving. In 10 years, our medical system will have been dismantled. The best doctors will have mostly retired or gone on strike, and the government will be so entrenched in the field that nothing will get rid of it. If you are my age, you may sneak by with the rest of your lifespan, counting on the remnants of private medicine that still exist. But if you are like many of the faces I see out there, in your teens, 20s, 30s, then God help you. To you, I want to conclude by saying, find out what is going on in this field. Don't take my word for it. And then act. Let people know the situation in whatever way is open to you. In particular, talk to your doctor. If you agree with the Declaration of Independence, tell him that he too comes under it. That he too is a human being with a right to life, and that you want to help protect his freedom and his income on purely selfish grounds. If you are looking for a crusade, there is none that is more idealistic or more practical. This one is devoted to protecting some of the greatest creators in the history of this country. And it is also literally a matter of life and death, your life and that of anyone you love. Don't let it go without a fight. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can I get more yelling in this class?
Yes. Peekoff, I want to thank you on behalf of the Ford Hall Forum for sharing your insights with us, for your careful and thoughtful analysis. We appreciate your returning to our podium, and now, as you know, it is the custom and tradition of the Ford Hall Forum to permit the members of the audience to ask questions. I'm going to try to start from my right to the left of the audience to see if we can give an opportunity for each area in the audience to ask some questions, but before I do, I'm going to exercise a rarely
exercise privilege of the moderator to ask you if you would just be kind enough to tell us a little bit about the Ayn Rand Institute.
Oh, sure. The Ayn Rand Institute, its purpose is in its subtitle. It's the Center for the Advancement of Objectivism, which is Ayn Rand's philosophy. It's centered in Los Angeles, and our primary purpose is to get objectivism taught in the universities. We regard the future of the country as depending on ideas, and the universities are the center of ideas, the center of disseminating ideas. Right now, the universities are shamefully closed to any philosophic dissent, and the primary mandate of the Institute is to penetrate this barrier by every means legal and possible, and we have a whole series of programs to achieve that purpose. Does that give you a capsule?
Thank you. I'll start over here on my right. As you know, it is our custom to permit the moderator to repeat the question in the microphone, so I ask you to be kind to me and please have your questions brief. Sir. The questioner asks, what does the AMA do with respect to the problems that you have presented today?
The AMA does what all these pressure groups on behalf of threatened industries do. Apologizes, appeases, and tries to have only 90% of the disaster passed at any given time. If the government decreed the beheading of all governments in the United States, the AMA would say, let's just do it west of the Mississippi. Practically speaking, and as an example, the government has frozen doctors' Medicare fee schedule, by law, and the AMA says this is an outrage, and what they advocate instead is a voluntary freeze of the same amount for the same period. So you can project on every issue. They are avowed publicists, you see, and so they feel they have to accept the avowed philosophy. And the avowed philosophy says they're guilty and evil for protesting against the sacrifice of doctors. So they apologize and say, we'll do it ourselves tomorrow. Just give us a chance.
Sir. The questioner asks whether or not there are any other works by Ayn Rand on epistemology other than the one which he did not name that he is.
Introduction to objectivism. Yeah.
Or is there anyone else doing any work on it?
She did not write any more on epistemology, but she left a lot of tapes from various workshops on epistemology, and there are provisional plans to publish at least excerpts from those or make them available in some way. Yes, there certainly are people applying her ideas to epistemology. There's a book scheduled to come out by Professor David Kelly next year called The Evidence of the Senses, which presents in great academic scholarly detail the objectivist view on that whole topic. I'm doing something on epistemology. If you call my general presentation of objectivism, it's going to have a large section on it, and there are other people working in the area.
On the
Institute is being raised in hospitals as well as the backlog of DON applications in this state that have been approved. They have nothing to do with rising healthcare costs in this state. It's actually the highest.
Are you at? I'm sorry.
What is your question?
I'm asking you to address the issue of the waste in the hospitals as well as the backlog of DON applications in this state, which I believe have a definite
The questioner asks you to comment on inefficiency in hospitals and the rising number of DON applications.
I don't know what DON is.
What are DON? That's a
CON.
It's the equivalent of CON.
Okay.
Questioner asks, that you comment on the backlog of CON or DON applications and inefficiency in the hospitals and the impact that has upon rising health care costs.
Yes, I'm sure there is a lot of inefficiency in hospitals, primarily because hospitals have been government controlled for such a long period of time. And lived through many, many years where the floodgates from Washington were open. They were drowned in money. There was absolutely no economic reason for them to be efficient in those years. In the 60s and 70s, you could build a hospital if you simply knew the right tap in Washington to turn on, and it wasn't that hard to get to know. There was no incentive or reason for them to economize. Now, of course, the government is making them not economize, but as I tried to indicate in my talk, cut not only fat, but muscle and bone, and in fact, the entire patient out of the scheme in many cases. But I do not blame hospitals in a private system. The thing is, we have no private system, and the only way to get rid of that inefficiency, if that's what concerns you, is to return them to complete private enterprise in medicine. If you want to know what causes efficiency, look at inefficiency, look at the post office. Look at any government program and say, is the solution to inefficiency more government, or to get the government out? As to, I guess you call it DON, people that I've talked to call it CON, I have to reiterate the point from my talk. In a private system, machinery, new beds, new technology does not increase costs. In a private system, if a hospital builds too many beds and can't fill them, it simply goes under. And that is very instructive to its competitors not to do it. You don't see GM or people in the automobile industry having to get certificates of need, and imagine what would happen to the automobile industry if there was a czar in Washington who had to tell them how many wheels they could put on cars, how many screws, and they had to stand in line for permissions of need. There would certainly be a tremendous backlog because they spend all their time on coffee breaks anyway before they process them. And the result would be the complete destruction of the automobile industry. So the problem is not the new machinery. It's the fact that there's no economic structure that makes them have to be efficient in the utilization of it. And that just requires private enterprise.
It seems as though you're cost containment and your fear of malpractice are pushing the doctors and hospitals exactly the opposite direction.
Correct. I'm sorry.
So what I'd like to know is, are the hospitals and doctors presently tending to spend too little for fear of the cost cap, or do too much for fear of malpractice, or do destroy the hospital?
If the questioner asks, if cost containment on the one hand pushes reduces expenditures, and fear of malpractice increases expenditures, do they balance each other out by resulting in hospitals spending just the right amount?
Unfortunately, no. What happens is we're just within the first year or so of this program, and nobody knows what to do. There's actually experts going around the country addressing conventions of doctors and telling them to be thankful for the malpractice laws, because the doctors can use the malpractice laws against the hospital administrator and say, you must give this patient the test, otherwise I'll let him know and he'll sue us, you see. So the doctors themselves, some of them, are upholding the malpractice nightmare as a wedge against the whole situation is just completely insane. It varies entirely from place to place. In some places, a strong hospital administrator and the doctors just toe the line. You know, if that's one or two hospitals in the area and they have a lot of power, they just simply cut out services. In other places, the doctors still have a lot of their traditional prestige. It's a very new thing for this power to be put in the hands of hospital administrators. And they half are still trying to, you know, be friendly with the doctors who were their one-time heads, and half are now starting to wield the whip because they've been put in charge. And each doctor and hospital negotiates. They're feeling each other out. It's a very, very unpleasant situation. And if you're the patient, it's Russian roulette. Which one you fall into, which administrator, which doctor, whether he feels like having a fight today or not. That's exactly what's happened.
And back. The questioner asks whether, in addition to impact upon the patient care system, whether there are any impacts from this medical reimbursement system upon research.
Yes, there definitely are very severe ones. I had a whole section in my speech, which I had to cut owing to lack of time, on that very point. In essence, what it amounts to is this: a tremendous amount of research was done through university hospitals and financed through the Medicare system. Those hospitals are now being squeezed out. They're being pressed against the wall, and research is extremely expensive and not remunerated. And consequently, it is a body blow to university hospitals, and in that way is having tremendous negative effects on research. This whole CON program is disastrous. I've spoken to people in the field of medical technology, that is, who are in the business of inventing and marketing new machinery, and they say that it's a body blow to their whole area because the hospitals are intimidated now into trying to do without new machinery. There's the constant fight for getting the pull to allow the new machinery, and if they get one new piece of machinery, they lose their rights to more beds and they have to negotiate. And there's no motivation. The hospital simply, even if they get the new machinery, don't have the money and the government won't fund the use of it. And consequently, it's having, so far, that's of course going to be the long-range results, it's right now nipping in the bud, killing off, destroying the incentive for a tremendous amount of research which would be vital to improve medical care. I'm thank you for asking that because it's a very important point.
Thank you. Dr. Peacock.
Questioner asks whether or not you would favor continued support of the elderly, the blind, the disabled, and those who have been under the system for a long period of time.
Well, I indicated at the end of my talk, once a program is established, you cannot, without ample warning, cut off people who have been made dependent on it. You couldn't take somebody 65 who's blind and say, oh, this program is wrong, goodbye, die on the street. Now, that is simply wrong. You have to phase these programs out in stages. And you have to indicate to people who are now 35 and can see, you better put money in the bank, because if you get to be 65 and blind, it's on your head. What I say is, though, after a preliminary transition, there should be no government intervention in medicine for anyone. Sick, healthy, blind, sighted, old, young, over or under 65 with $1 million or zero. None. I would say abolish government in the field of medicine altogether. If I gave a speech on how the government is destroying bread and the baking of bread, it would not be valid to say, what about people who are hungry? If you're worried about people who are hungry, the first thing is there's got to be bread. And then if you can't kill a baker's, then you can say to the baker's, there's a few people who are hungry, would you be a nice guy and contribute a loaf every once in a while if this guy really can't help himself? That's what voluntary charity means. That is the only thing you can do with bread, and that's the only thing you can do with medicine. The alternative to try to harness and enslave the providers of medical services in the name of the alleged rights of the needy is immoral, and the consequence in practice is you simply wipe out the needy along with everybody else. If you want a lesson in what does government medical care mean, you don't even have to go to Britain anymore. Go to Medicaid. Medicare, they still have a veneer of concern because Medicare includes wealthy people. But Medicaid is really for poor people. And you should see the medical treatment that Medicaid patients get. As the government says, we have not attempted to maintain quality in the Medicaid program. So if you're worried about the needy, you better be for laissez-faire capitalism.
Questioner asks whether or not the same risks involved in a government-funded program are also involved in third-party paid programs.
Yes, that's an excellent question. I also had a whole passage on that I had to cut. I love the questions that bring out the stuff I couldn't get in. It's very commonly believed that it's the principle of medical insurance as such which is the villain here, and not simply government. I disagree with that completely. In every other field where you have private insurance, you have no such problem. You do not have the problem in the case of automobiles where you have automobile accidents. You don't have people promiscuously driving over a cliff because after all the insurance company pays it. You don't have them setting fire to their house because they have fire insurance. Because this is the thing, in every other field, indirectly, even if not directly, you, the user of insurance, pays. If you run up, for instance, a terrible driving record, your insurance bills are prohibitive. The insurance company is not losing money on you. So one way or the other, in a profit-making system, in a private insurance system, the insurance company is going to make you pay for what you get from them. Otherwise, how are they going to stay in business? So the problem is not insurance. The problem is insurance which does not fall on the back of the person who uses it. And that's exactly what is happening now. If we had private insurance companies, they would come to you next year, for instance, and say, well, look, you had appendectomy, a gastrectomy, who knows what else last year. We can't keep you on our rolls for $50 next year. Your fee next year is now $25,000. And after that, you'd be very careful what you ate so as not to get another gastrectomy. But if the government is paying, what's it to you? And today, the government is doing it. Whether it's called Blue Cross or Blue Shield doesn't make any difference. HMOs, for instance, are forbidden by law to define their premiums according to the health of their patients. They must give the same cost to everybody. If you come in and you're a teenager strapping in health, and you are a basket case of 85, they get the same exact price by law. So you can see why the government is all for HMOs, because they want to herd all the elderly Medicare patients into HMOs, because it'll cut their costs. That the fact that the Medicare, what's going to happen to those people, what do they care?
A couple of questions from this side. Yes, sir. Questioner asks whether there is any mechanism to help support doctors defending themselves.
There is all kinds of doctors' groups protesting, but I do not know of any that are doing it by the method that would be required if they were to accomplish anything. In other words, by reference to a proper philosophy. They are arguing, as far as I can see, on this given program is not practical, and let's have a different form of government intervention instead. The problem is to get doctors to see the ideological, the philosophic roots of the crisis, and that I do not know anybody doing. As far as the mechanism, what I am doing, have already done, is circulated this speech quite widely in draft form among, I think we must have sent it out to well over 24 different medical groups, to see if they're interested in the ideas and to see what response. That was just done very recently, so I can't really report on what the consequences are. I do know the Ayn Rand Institute, as one of its projects, is going to try to disseminate this speech to the medical profession, or at least to leading members of it. I don't know any other method. I wish I did.
Last question.
Good question.
Questioner asks whether or not the AMA's monopoly has a tendency to produce the results you have discussed.
Yes, it does. It does in exactly the way you could make this point. You know the way Ayn Rand always used to argue that businessmen in the 19th century were the ones who ran to government for special protection, subsidies, tariff protection, and so on. And those 19th century businessmen who did it were the ones who were responsible for delivering all the later innocents into the clutches of the government. You can make an analogy to the medical field, because doctors demanded government licensing. They demanded monopolistic control of who could and couldn't practice medicine. They arrogated political power in this field by their own demand, and a lot of them were behind the original program. You know, as I indicated, they thought this will mean money pouring into the medical field. Those doctors in the early decades of this century who started that attitude are still in the AMA. Not all of the AMA are like that, but some certainly are. And they are certainly very, very grievously responsible. But as I say, there's a tremendous number of completely innocent doctors. The solution in this regard is there should not be government licensing of medical practice. That is not something that is a proper function of a government. In a free society, you do not have to go to an ignorant bureaucrat and ask for a ticket to practice a scientific specialty. You depend... You depend on the intelligence of the consumer, and in this case of the patient, to investigate himself, to check into the education of the doctor, to see what kind of cures he's had, what kind of record he has. You rely on the marketplace, and that will give you a standard of quality 1,000 times superior to what you'll get by government certification. You know what building inspectors do in New York City? How they inspect elevators, that's exactly the protection you get from government license. made a note to myself on several pages, and I forgot. I want to just publicly thank my brother, because he is a surgeon in Nevada. He's here tonight, right in the front. And he is the one who taught me everything I know about the medical field. He called me about 6 months ago, and he said, why don't you tell people what's going on in the field of medicine? I hadn't the faintest idea what he was talking about. He, in effect, gave this lecture to me on the phone, and I just put it down, so I would like to acknowledge with thanks his help.
Dr. Peikoff has kindly indicated that he will be available briefly in the Frost Lounge, which is out at the front of the auditorium, should any of you wish to ask any further questions. Thank you.